Rusty Quill presents.
We've confirmed tonight at least one person was killed in that explosion at a metal plant in...
He finally showed up after a lot of public pressure all week.
Wireland Ranch, an amalgamation.
Hi, friends. Thank you for coming to see us again here round the bend, but I think this time you may want to reconsider. You see, I had every intention of taking you back into the future with me, tied to a tree dripping with honey and waiting for the ants to come, but certain events have made this prospect untenable. So then, where do we find ourselves? Do we follow our Agent Orange through his indoctrination before he helps find the key to the end of everything? Do we pay a visit to our dog and worm Funtime Brother Buddy story? Do I fill in how Abria became queen of the Lotophages on the Isle of Jerba, oh, so many years ago? Or do I present an unabridged history of the palindromes? Maybe I should tell you exactly who is imprisoned inside of our war-torn sphinx. We could even go back to my first foray into the long-buried Mojave Logistics headquarters where I found the videotapes that will soon make up the totality of the Mojave memos. But no, friends, none of these seem quite right. Though these answers will be apparent eventually, I think it's time we got a little personal. Not with me, mind you. I don't matter in this chain of events until a ways down the road, and that is if my captors have a change of heart at some point in the next day or two, three, at the most. The honey will only coat the skin for so long, a sugary, sweet shield currently protecting me from the very real and seemingly unavoidable pain I see on the horizon. No, friends. I think today we should pay a visit to our overseer deep in the recesses of his mind and history. And as Vati Vidya used to say in the long dead days of deep dive video game story time, prepare to cry. It's canon. It's in the lore. His eyes blink open. Bright fluorescent light floods his visual cortex and renders his surroundings in painstaking detail. His brain both processes and creates the reality he finds himself in, a hospital room. Stark white and gleaming metal sanitizer scents and the copper tinge of blood in the air. He is groggy and disoriented until a searing pain in his left side seizes him and brings tears to his young eyes. He stares up at the drop ceiling tiles and shifts himself in the bed. His mother runs into the room. "Don't move, baby," she says. "Try to be still." She places a cylinder in his hand with a button at the top and says, "If it hurts too bad, baby, just push the button." It does, so he does, and a wave of opiates carry him away into the yawning void of sleep. His eyes flash again, now 30 years older, but this time there is no light, no render of reality, a dark, lonely chasm occupied by himself and God knows what else. He finds himself in that viscous embryonic fluid with something eating at his brain. He's been here before. He knows he has. That creature that held him still in the air, body blazing and stuck, staring his death in the face and then back again into the fluid. And that voice, that fucking voice, he rips his arms from the fluid and pulls himself to his feet. The pain returns, sharp and forbidding, the kind of pain that turns the very reality around you into your enemy. He is strapped to the hospital bed to prevent sudden, erratic movement. Every orifice of his body, except for the anus, has a tube or wires sticking out like His body has become a garden of medical breakthrough technology. All of these things that shouldn't be where they are, but here they are nonetheless. He scans the room for his mother. She said she'd be right there with him the entire time, but he cannot see her. He does not remember why he is here. It's dancing on the edge of his memory, taunting his developing mind, and he doesn't realize it yet, friends, but he will carry far more scars away from this ordeal than anyone could have anticipated. Fraggle Rock blinks onto the soundless television, and he rests his eyes there for a moment, trying to trick the pain by not paying attention, but friends, we all know distraction never works for long. He pushes the button his mother gave him again, but this time there's no wave of euphoric peace coming to save him, no. Instead of that, a man in a lab coat walks into the room, smiles at him, takes the magic button away and sets it aside. The man looks at him through soft green eyes, his smile widens uncomfortably, and he says, "Let's get that tube out of you. What do you say?" Scanning the space around him, his shuffling feet crushing thick yet fragile stalks of something that could be flesh as easily as vegetation beneath them, the darkness is encompassing, as though he's been swallowed whole by a sky both starless and Bible black. His senses tell him very little. The only sound is his stumble. The smell is overwhelming yet unidentifiable, sour and stagnant. Air that has never been taken into lungs. He rotates and strains for any fragment of light, any inkling of a way out.
Joseph, you should run.
The man in the lab coat sits on a chair beside his bed. It squeaks slightly, but in our patient's ears, it is the only thing that can be heard. His mother steps into the room. He can see her, but this doctor, this motherfucker, says, "Ma'am, you need to leave. You don't want to see this." She glances at our patient, her child, with a sad and broken glare, like maybe, secretly, she had hoped for the procedure to fail, hoped he would never again open his eyes, because even though she does not want to admit it, her life would be easier without the weight on her shoulders, and the truth of this vicious little thought will only become more apparent over time, more cost, less benefit. Constant heartache with very little payoff. She'd never say it out loud, but the look is enough, even for our 9-year-old patient to grasp, and it isn't her fault. It's 1991, and Reagan set a series of events in motion that will never, ever trickle down to her. It will only get worse as the years go by, and these medical bills, they will drive her into bankruptcy, only not the rich people version one files when they're tired of paying their employees and go home to the mansion, but rather the version for poor folk that leaves a mark that cannot be ignored for years and years. She steps back out of the hospital room as the man in the lab coat grips a surgical drain sticking out of our patient's side and tells him to count to 3. "I will pull on 3, he says. "Don't worry, this will not hurt a bit." Our patient closes his eyes in preparation and begins to count. 1, 2. And this was the first time our patient heard the voice that lives inside his head.
"They lied to you. They will never tell you the truth."
Violent thrashing approaches him from behind, a rumble breaking the dead silent space. He fumbles forward, tripping on the stalks and launching himself into the space before him. He struggles back to his feet and feels a hot, wet splash from his forehead coating his face and making his skin slick and sticky. He scrambles along the perimeter, his hands sliding along the wall he crashed into in an attempt to prevent it from happening again. The sound behind him thrashes ever closer, echoing, vibrating through him. He knocks on the walls, beating it with his fist as his desperation grows until he notices a change in the sound.
"It's almost here."
With each beat.
"Push hard."
"It is coming, Joseph. It is here and it is coming. You should sit down and wait. You cannot win. Just let it happen." You fought your entire life, but you can rest now. All is well.
He smashes his shoulder into the wall and feels it give slightly.
Just sit down. You have never won a battle in your whole life. This does not change today. Give up.
He crashes into the wall one last time, and
don't
this round he does not stop.
It.
The wall rips like
push
paper.
Right there.
For a moment, he feels suspended in midair, hovering still like some Looney Tune, but friends, gravity wins, even in this place, and the wind rushes by him, but he can feel it approaching. The termination, the end, the bottom, because, as a great man once said, physics makes us all its bitch. Three weeks after the hospital, he found himself at home, freshly repaired heart and chest, brand new friend living in his brain, and a cartoon hobbit on the television that had to be rewound every 77 minutes. Another inconvenience for his poor parents, or at least that is what the voice likes to say. He has to lay still for 2 months, or the gash in his side just under his ribs will reopen. Though moving is the furthest thing from his mind, and every time he comes close to thinking about it, his body is there to remind him. And here we find the roots of his accursed life, the unholy trinity of plagues that will ride ever forward on fire-breathing steeds, trampling him at every twist and unfortunate turn his world will take. First, his heart. Born with a rare congenital blockage in the aorta that was not found in his infancy, the doctors made sure to hammer home just how rare that is. Less than a month ago, he was running around the field with the football suit on, falling far behind the kids his coach referred to as weak, meaning, in toxic macho language, too thin, or too fat, or too feminine, or too anything other than aggressive future date raping real boys. He had fallen over somewhere along the perimeter of the field, nose bleeding profusely despite lack of injury. The coach runs toward him, yelling him to get up, yelling, "Okay, prissy boy, we will just leave you there," and they did. He was not helped until his mother arrived to pick him up after a long day at the salon, and those weak kids, well, they begged the coach to assist him, even made attempts themselves, but each time they were forced to dash again, pointlessly, like the pussies their fathers constantly told them they were, you see, friends. Joseph had no blood flow in his legs. It was concentrated in his upper body, and it needed a place to go, so life, as we all know, found a way. Second, the drugs. When he pressed that button from his hospital bed Fraggle Rock fever dream, he found a lifelong friend. A friend that would always take his pain away and make him feel better regardless of the circumstances of his life. A friend who would caress him in places a lover never could. A friend the Sackler family would propagate across the country that he lived in to toss lives into bottomless pits and arrest those that survive, all the while making the prettiest of pennies. In his adulthood, the government would pretend to take that family to task and force consequences onto them, such as removing their name from the university library. Needless to say, that had to sting them pretty bad. Meanwhile, your grandmother got addicted during a short-lived bout of breast cancer, and while the cancer didn't kill her, the overdose did. His body slammed against the ground.
Have you had enough yet? All you have to do is lay here.
Stop listening to him and get up. Get up and run.
He can hear that same screech above him falling ever closer, and the voice is right. Why does he fight so hard to maintain the breath that allows him to stay in constant contact with the torturous demon of a life he was always told was a fucking gift? After all, He survived a deadly congenital birth defect for 9 full years. He must be meant for something, right? He must be chosen for something, right? You can likely guess by now the third and arguably most devastating plague, the voice.
Now we're getting somewhere.
At first, he was able to ignore it, pretending it wasn't there until one day he could pretend no longer. Throughout his childhood, the voice made sure to let him know at every opportunity his life is ultimately a burden to everyone around him. He would never be able to work due to his heart, never be able to play the sports ball games or hide and seek with the new friends he made, which did not live inside his head. Originally, it was somewhat comforting, especially when he found himself alone in his mother's room watching The Hobbit for the 600th time. It was conversational, and it seemed to know more about him than he knew of himself, which was not a difficult proposition given his age. It pretended it cared for him and only wanted to protect him from the world, from his parents, and most importantly, from himself, but friends. It did not take too long for those around him to determine something was not quite right. They found him mumbling to himself, having full-on conversations about weighty topics like death and fate and sometimes the song Go Ninja Go by one Mr. Vanilla Ice. His parents ignored these full-on private convos via various forms of mental gymnastics to somersault around the truth. That perhaps this child that cost them so much money and effort and time and heartbreak and essentially cursed them to poverty, though they'd never stop chasing the dragon of that elusive American dream. Well, maybe he was also victimized by mental illness. Before him, as he runs and trips and rolls about, a pale pink and indiscriminately diseased landscape unfolds. The foliage is fleshy and bleeding and seems to reach toward him as he passes. Red mist envelops him and dissipates just as quickly as though he is traveling through low-lying viscera clouds, acting as fog wherever the fuck he finds himself. The thrashing behind him has not ceased, a wave of dread-inducing noise nipping at his heels. His breath is hard and hot in his chest, searing in his lungs. He has to stop just for a moment, if only to catch his breath.
Just a little farther. Come to the base of the tower.
As the palindrome speaks, the ground begins to rumble around him, the white noise giving chase squeals. If Joseph was in the right frame of mind, he might realize the squeal holds a tinge of fear, and taking this information toward its natural conclusion would lead him to the awareness that if there is fear, there is also weakness. The shaking ground knocks his legs from under him, and he flips forward again. He's so fucking tired.
Just let it happen.
Walls break through the slick, fleshy terra firma. His hand, having fallen where the wall broke the ground as it slid up into reality, went with it. And now he is no closer to understanding anything around him, and short a hand to boot. But as his appendage ascended into the heavens, he had a sudden realization that should have been obvious from the moment he opened his eyes. You see, friends, as his hand grows back while he watches, expression wrapped with terrifying awe, he realizes. And the voice made sure he always remained isolated from everyone and everything. Whenever he formed a new relationship, that voice would swoop in for a bit of the old self-imposed emotional ultraviolence. It would scream so loudly within the confines of his skull that he would hurt himself to make it go away, to stop thinking about it for a single fucking second. And when he hurt himself, he drove everyone else just a little further away. Then comes the drug lust. It's a cycle. A cycle he never thought he'd be able to break, a cycle that would continue through his teens, and it seemed every 5 or 6 years he was having another heart procedure, another out of intense pain and months of lying in bed immobile, and over time the Hobbit was edged out a tad more and replaced with increasingly darker media, both real and otherwise. Anything to make him feel like someone, anyone, has it worse than he does. Whenever he made a mistake, the voice nagged and wore him down, berated him into numb acceptance. He would be alone for the entirety of his life. He may as well go ahead and accept it now before he causes himself or anyone else unnecessary pain and anguish. Throughout his teen years, he became more and more dependent on harder and harder drugs until by the age of 19, he found himself in quite the heroin trap quagmire. For the addict, addiction is a conundrum constantly combed through in the mind. They know they do not want the drug, but they also know they want nothing else but the drug. This cognitive dissonance allows the thoughts to spin and spin about in the mind until the question becomes too difficult to confront. Because of the state of things, TM, reaching out for help is likely to lead to more trouble than the fractured junkie brain can cope with, and thus becomes no more than a new step in a ceaseless cycle. And when that help does come, if ever, it's often coupled with religious nonsense the addict has an inherent aversion to. And for those who have no preconceived religious aversions, well, they just replace one addiction with a God who only cares if your devotion comes with a 10% price tag. But one thing we all realize more and more each day is the system is not designed to help, but rather to hold down, to firmly plant one's face in the dregs of a polluted lake made of money and labor and shame. He realizes, when he sees the same hand in two different places simultaneously, that maybe, just maybe, this place is less real than he initially conceived. As the tower forms and settles before his eyes, a door hewn from a single piece of carved bone and adorned with a symbol made of petrified wood appears on the wall with a flash of blinding pink light. And for just a moment, as he passes through, he knows he's seen that symbol before. It is simple, elegant, an expertly carved orchid in a jar.
Do not go in there.
Again, his reality has changed. He finds himself in a bunk surrounded by prison walls. He has been in solitary confinement for close to 8 months with a copy of Twilight and the Prison Handbook as his only company. He did attempt to read Twilight, but even in this impressive state of boredom, he could not make it through the first chapter. Though if he had to pick one way or another, Team R-Pats for fucking life. His addiction led, as addictions often do, straight into the big house. He was caught with a half a gram of heroin, but in the little town he was arrested in, you'd think he had a pocket full of Satan. And they gave him 4 years, and unfortunately for him, his arrest likely kept him alive. The voice was less active during this period, and he found if he focused, he could almost ignore it completely. He would, upon release, take this skill with him and use it to build a life he never believed he could have. So when Halloween of the third year came around, he was out and thrust back into the world. A year of parole later, and it was as if it never happened to begin with. As you might expect, the voice did return with a vengeance upon his release, because that voice serves only one purpose, friends. To keep him isolated to the point that if he were to ever go missing, there'd be very few people willing to look for him. Inside the tower, he finds a single plank of petrified wood with an orchid carved out of its center on the floor. The walls are lit as if by the sun. The air dances with sweet fragrance. Something about this place feels different. Feels untouched by whatever hell has taken over the landscape just outside, which could be a million miles from here and traveled by no more than a humble step.
I'm so glad you made it, Joseph. It was touch and go from there. Come on up to see us.
Joseph steps forward as the plank starts to shake as if it were attempting to wiggle out of gravity's grasp and free itself from the laws of reality. And once he plants his feet firmly in the middle, the plank does just that. But, you see, friends, Those years of confinement allowed him to not only have a better grasp of who he is, but also provided enough peace of mind and comfort in that knowledge to finally, after all these long and miserable years, understand the voice was not him at all. And if he didn't know better, he would almost assume it was so foreign he would never be able to fully grasp where it did come from. And friends, in that, he would not be far off from the truth. After prison, he did his best to work in a stable job, but unlike the voice, his soft machinery could not be easily ignored. And as he got older, the procedures and medical concerns only grew more frequent, but still, despite all of life's violence and myriad mazes without solutions, Joseph found another person that made him happy. As the plank rises, the bone door he walked through mere moments ago fractures and burns into ash. Everything stops. From the gash in the wall where the door used to be, laced black tendrils grip the edges of the cracked stone. Inch by inch and farther in, as they move, they leave behind silken black trails, and if one were to look close enough into them, they would see the tattered fringes of the fabric at the center of everything. The fabric that was meant to be cycled through long ago, but found itself arrested, stagnant, and headed toward the type of oblivion it cannot come back from. And unfortunately, either way, you and me, and everyone we know, are destined to keep it company all the way down. The cirrus weave their way closer, each slither and slide sucking the light from the tower, consuming fresh, fragrant air and processing it through a pestilence filter and back into the room as silver miasma that burns his nostrils and gnashes at his eyes. The tendrils grow larger as they coil and curl along the walls and onto the floor, their diameters growing as they approach, filling in the hole left by the door with the same fleshy stalks he remembers from his first encounter with this place. When he ripped himself from the embryonic pool in which he'd awoken, the tendrils halt their motion toward him. The plank beneath him shakes as if coming back to life from the creases and black silken cracks left in the wake on the walls. A golden glow seeps through. The glimmer hardens the cirrus and travels along their links. Hundreds, maybe thousands, of worm-like coils appear, if only for a moment, as glittering solid gold before shattering into mist. You see, friends, this person he found himself caring about more than the air keeping him alive in his lungs was shattered in her own way. Abused by men in her life from the age 8 and on, but there is beauty in the broken, and when two people are cracked just so, they can glue themselves together and make both whole again. And this is exactly what they did. They laid in bed for days when they met, having those conversations that seemed to stop time itself and freeze all the tragedy and heartbreak and soiled, rotten histories for a short but brief respite. He was honest with her about everything, so when his friend did rear its ugly head, they were both prepared to meet it head on, and though they did struggle, each in their own ways, they could no longer be harmed by the fractious circumstances of their lives. He started to do deliveries when he could after their first child was born. It was rare, but he did his best to help, and when his body was keeping him down, then he provided support in different ways and tried to alleviate her stress wherever it might originate from. 2 years later, they had their second child, and that was when he began to understand maybe he was meant for more. He made a difference in the lives of the people he loved, people he thought he'd never have, and friends. You and I know this is the most any of us can strive for. The mist snaps back onto itself, and as quickly as it shattered, it took form once again, and what he sees before him evokes a particular and exceedingly sinister feeling that is hard to place one's finger on. He has only felt this feeling once before, in his early 20s when he went camping once, alone. He took pictures of birds and the sunset, and later, before bed, the moon and stars in the sky. A few days later, he had those pictures developed, and as he flipped through them, he found pictures he did not take of himself while he slept.
Why so frightened?
A few weeks ago, Joseph's partner got COVID. Her boss did not believe this was an issue and attempted to make her come to work despite this fact. She said no, as any reasonable person would, what with having a moral issue with becoming a vector of disease within her community, and was immediately and unceremoniously fired. Common story for sure, and even more common is what comes after. You might not think being $175 short on the rent would be an issue when they paid six times that each month for the two-bedroom apartment in which they lived, but day in and day out, the landlord comes a-knocking. The parasite speaks as any parasite would when one of their tenants among the 185 properties they own needs a helping hand, with threats and vile superiority. The parasite asks if his children know their parents are deadbeat losers who can't afford to provide them with a place to live. The parasite says this loud enough for his children to hear, both huddled together and crying behind him in the doorway, because they don't understand why this is happening. It says,
"You don't want them to live on the street, do you?"
It says,
"I'm sure your wife can make things right with that sweet ass she carries around."
The parasite says these things with a confident tongue, leading Joseph to believe it has been successful before. The parasite says,
"A little pussy might buy you and your family a couple of days. You can even watch if you'd like. But let me warn you. After she gets this, you might not be able to pull her off of me."
Joseph felt the pain in his chest reminding him not to do something which might leave his children alone in a world that produced the pile of human trash that stood before him, asking for money, always asking for money. The children were sobbing. The parasite smiled one last time and turned to whistle its way to its Audi TT. As it opens the door to its car, it says,
"Have my money, or have her looped up and waiting. Your choice."
Joseph's 8-year-old child looks up at him and asks, tears still flowing from his innocent eyes, he says, "Daddy, what does lubed up mean?" And friends, how do you honestly answer that? The gold mist creature walks around him, the plank shaking violently under his feet. Sharp golden appendages grip his ankle and harden in place like cosmic handcuffs, pulling him down as the plank shakes steadily upward toward whatever was calling him toward the precipice. Just below the plank, he can see flaxen-tinged eyes that lock onto a stair, those same tendrils writhing out from inside them, shooting forward and gripping him by the throat. The tendrils harden and sharpen around his neck, tearing at his flesh. The pain is blinding and clears his thoughts, reducing him to that thing we are when the fight or flight kicks in. But what this thing does not seem to understand is, instead of fighting or flighting, this guy fucks. He might be weak in body, but spirit and mind are an entirely different story. The chime seemed different on the last delivery he made. The bright focus group approved Pavlovian dinging that ushered in slave wage delivery terms onto his screen was muted and slow. Seemed deeper, darker, and somehow, as he considered the memory, more than a little unwelcoming.
By giving you no time instead of it all, till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. They hurt you at home and hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. So you're so fucking scared you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. Tortured and scared you for 20-odd years. Then they expect you to pick a career, but you can't hardly function, you're so full of fear. Sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. There's room at the top, they keep telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. Be a hero and just follow me.